This is a recording of the experiences and reminiscences of Mr. R. Lee Slider. The narrator is Mr. Slider, and the interviewer is Betty Turnell. The recording is being made at the request of the Decatur Public Library in Decatur, Illinois, and we are recording on January 20th, 1984, at the Rock Springs Center for Environmental Discovery. Mr. Slider, you're an interpretive naturalist for the Macon County Conservation District. Well, exactly what does an interpretive naturalist do?
Well, that's an interesting title. And what we do here, there are six of us that are interpretive naturalists, that we try to interpret the environment of Rock Springs or Macon County Conservation District properties or the area in which we live, both geologically, biologically, culturally, for our visitors, whether they be school children or interested adults. And it's kind of like a guide, in a sense, but we have to do a tremendous amount of research and then be able to take that information, regurgitate it, and put it in a language that everybody can understand. And as I said, there's six of us here. My job is just a little different than the others, since our backgrounds are mostly in the sciences, dealing with biology, forestry, what have you. I'm really more of a cultural interpreter, but there is no slot for that. So my job is to take the information about people who once lived here on our properties, or in Macon County, or in this particular area, and interpret for the people their feelings and moods and how they participated within their environment, what they did to change it, and how much the environment changed them. It's all part of the story.
Well, it really sounds fascinating, and I know we want to know more about all of that, but before we come back to that, why don't we hear something about your childhood and early life? I believe you lived in this area, didn't you, in Decatur itself?
Yes, I was born and raised here in Macon County, Decatur, Macon County. Spent 4 years in the Navy and went off to see the world and so forth. Came back, went to Millikan University. Yes, I spent most of my life here.
Okay. Well, what were Decatur and Macon County like when you were growing up?
Well, when I was a child, of course, it was the tail end of the Great Depression. And I have visions, of course, of what Decatur was like. Some of them were. But I think I can remember, I can just barely remember streetcars. And they've been gone a long while. And, of course, the focus of the community, transportations in those days, was by bus. And the transfer house seemed to be the focus of the community in those days, where most people used the downtown area, and the mass transportation was well used. I remember a lot about World War II as a child.
Oh.
And my father going off to war and coming back unexpectedly. And I remember ROTC young men marching in the streets. I remember some of the things, the war trophies, for example, from Rommel's Africa Corps that were set in the middle of El Dorado Street in front of the armory. And all of the kids, of course, crawled all over these things. Japanese midget submarines that were brought to Decatur in those years, and scrap drives. Oh, I took part in those when we were a child. Ration cards and ration points. I remember my father had a 1932 or 33 Chevrolet coupe that, when the war broke out, he put it up on blocks because you couldn't get a number, or excuse me, the letters for gasoline, A, B, and C cards for your window. And I guess we were pretty poor at that time. He sold a car. And what really upset him, I think, the most, and I'll never forget, was that it had a tank of gas in it. So that really upset him because he didn't get the money for the gasoline. But then after the war, of course, was in the higher grades and in the junior high school and high school. Went to the old Decatur High and went at it in St. Teresa where, well, I think Lakeview was just built at that time. We're the only high schools. And pretty happy memories about those years. And seeing the city in the 50s, early 50s, late 40s, early 50s as bustling and growing people trying to put their lives back together again after the war and so forth.
There was a lot of optimism then, wasn't there, after the war was
over?
Oh, yes.
A lot of new businesses. I guess a little later it became the time of the organization man, but yes, a lot of optimism.
A good time to be any place in the United States then. You changed career. You went into the Navy. What time was that, Mr. Slider?
Well, it was during the tail end of the Korean War, mm-hmm. And I had just gotten out of high school, and I really didn't feel that I would gain as much in the Army. Since I was going to have to go one way or the other, that I thought the Navy would be a greater opportunity to see things that I never had a chance to see. One of the stories, I said I went down to the post office one time to mail a letter and never came home for 4 years. And I joined the Navy and went off and had a chance to go around the world before I was 21 years old and visited many different places and saw a lot of different people in different ways and cultures. I think it was at that time that I became aware then that there was much more, you know, to our world than a young teenager would normally imagine. Very complex, and that I had a desire to learn as much as possible. I always had an interest in history, and having a chance to visit Rome, some of the other places of ancient civilizations, it was very educational. Mm-hmm. So I gained a lot about what I use even today from those years in service.
So you came home, and how did you eventually get in this field?
Well, I didn't normally. I wanted to try to be in the Park Service after I got out of the Navy, and I was out in California, San Diego, and my wife and I both worked for one of the aircraft companies, and we had no intention of coming back here, but they had a lot of government contracts in the firm that we worked, and the overtime was canceled, and as a result, many people lost their jobs. And I lost mine. And we decided that since there were so many people in Southern California that you just couldn't find a job, that we would come back to Decatur. And I think the night that we arrived, I was convinced by my father-in-law that I should start Milligan University. And I did. And granted, I never planned to go to college because we never had the money. But now I had the GI Bill, and that was probably one of the best things that ever happened, as far as myself personally. And so I went to Milliken for 4 years, and then our children came along, and I had to get into to make a living, and I went to work for my father-in-law, who was the owner, one of the owners of Long Bond's Roofing Sheet Metal Company. And I worked there for 17 years mm-hmm. after that in the construction business. And after some years, finally reached the point of becoming vice president of the firm. But it wasn't a job that I really liked. And I felt that I was successful at it, but it just didn't satisfy. In the meantime, I still kept my hand in as far as history was concerned, because while I was in college, I did change my major to history and political science, and then my minored in industry. I felt that I still had something I wanted to offer, and I got together with some other people within the community, and we restarted the Macon County Historical Society back in the, I believe it was in 59 or somewhere mm-hmm. along in there. It had been dormant for years, and I belong to another organization that's still around called the Civil War Roundtable. Mm-hmm. And in I think it was about that time during the period when I was active in the Historical Society that we found that most of the history of Macon County seemed to start with the time that the settlers came here in the 1820s. But yet people kept talking about Indians, and the books that were printed at that time said, well, there was never any Indians around this part of the country, or any history of them to any great extent. And yet there seems to be so much evidence that they had been. So I became very interested in pursuing that aspect of our unknown history, and had an opportunity then to work with a rather famous archaeologist, C.G. Holland, from the Smithsonian Institute, on the now extant Oakley Reservoir. And we did archaeological surveys on that area that would be flooded. And by working with him through the Historical Society, he discovered somewhat like 50 to 100 prehistoric Indian sites just in that area alone. And from that, I began to learn about archaeology. And was introduced to the Illinois Archaeological Survey at Champaign, which was group within the state of Illinois that represented all of the universities that were working in the field of archaeology in Illinois. And I found in those years that there was a tremendous amount of information literally being dug out of the ground about our prehistoric past. I had thought, you know, that maybe we were talking 500 years of prehistoric past. But as time went on, we discovered that right here in Macon County, we can trace man's activities back to about 12,000 B.C., much beyond anyone's ever wildest ideas, and that the evidence is just under our feet, and much of it is still there if you just know what to look for and where to look. And then I trained myself to, with the help of other professional archaeologists, by working with others that had been working in this area in regard to the Oakley Reservoir, and then with the Illinois or the State Museum, Springfield, to train myself to be, I guess, what you'd call a para-archaeologist. And I also worked on projects that I felt that could be used in the schools in showing what historic sites in our particular area look like today, where these different activities actually took part that are referred to in other books. And where are those places? What do they look like now? And is there some evidence that they were here? And would not this be a better way of teaching local history than just out of a book that seems to be very dry? So I think that a lot of people have helped me along the way, and like Florence White from the Historical Society, used to be principal at Spencer School, dear lady, and gave me many opportunities to use her school as a testing ground for some of these presentations that I did. All of the folks that were in Historical Society were marvelous. Many of them are gone now. People at the Illinois State Museum, for example. Even Bruce McMillan, who is now director of the Illinois State Museum, in those days was the anthropologist there, was very helpful. Others that used to be there, like Bob Hall, now head of the Department of Anthropology at University of Illinois Chicago Circle Campus, and Stuart Strever and others who are famous in the United States in the field of archaeology have always been very helpful to me.
Well, you really had a real love of history. You have had that for a long time, evidently. I believe that you actually do a little impersonation of some of these characters, don't you? Isn't that right?
Well, yes, now we do. To get into that, I'll just back up just
all right,
a little
fine.
Bit. While I was doing all this work in the early 60s, we were very much in this community concerned about the Oakley Reservoir, and that it would increase the water supply for Decatur and Macon County, which was still growing at that time. And if this was coming, then a lot of archaeological sites were going to be destroyed. There were going to be a lot saved, too. But a good friend of mine, Norman Greenberg, runs Rambo's Drugstore at this particular point in time, was on a board of supervisors, county board of supervisors, and he was very much impressed by another supervisor, like Weber Borchers, for example, who said that if this reservoir is built, then the land around that reservoir should be set aside, not like Lake Decatur, and divided up into individual property areas that would have houses all about it, but should be set aside in a wild state for future generations. And this made a lot of sense. Norm started a movement to see about forming some kind of a county park system that would be the recipient of that land. We also took it a step further and said that there were various other places in the county that would not be affected by the reservoir that also should be saved in the rural community. For example, the Oglesby Mansion and the old Warnick Tavern, which was out here southwest of town, and certain vistas and wooded areas that may be destroyed because of the rapid expansion of the community. So Norm and several others like O.T. Banton, Gilbert Bond from Blue Mound, and Bob Stroyack, now gone, and Margaret Bringer, now deceased, and many other people got together really in Norm's basement, and we went out to find how to start a county park system. And we decided that the best thing to use was a new law called the Conservation Act, the Illinois Conservation Act. I think it was in 1964. And so we went out and we talked to everybody we could talk to. We gathered petitions and we got it on the ballot. We spent about $164.70 in advertising. And in 1967, it was on the ballot, and it passed in this county 2-1 in the Conservation District. Macon County Conservation District came into existence. And in those years, after that time, I acted somewhat as an unofficial advisor and so forth, and went to work for the district in 1978. And since my time here, I've been able to devote fully to the historical pursuits and others. Also learning about the natural aspect of things from my colleagues. And since that time, as we do research, we've still working on some of those ideas that we had back in the early 60s, using in the schools, audiovisual, trying to get the ideas across on what we're trying to teach. And as a result, now I find myself doing living history, impersonating. We have right here at Rock Springs the old Trowbaugh log house. We think that he's the man that built it. According to the records, as close as we can come, that he did. Joseph Trowbaugh was an actual person. He came here, he didn't make a big splash, not written up in the history books, except just mentioned briefly, like many others. But we have changed him from what he actually was into an everyman. An everyman who lived in Macon County probably from 1837 and to the point where we are impersonating him in 1860. So he fits a period, a person of my age. And we dress him up as closely as possible in the closing of that particular period of the 1860s. And assume his lifestyle, what we would say his dialect, speech pattern would be, his terrible habits that he would probably have to make him human. And he recites or enacts what he has seen of Decatur, Macon County, from the time that he came here, and what he has done, how he is affected by those changes of those particular years in our history, which are not well explained in the written histories, because written histories have a tendency to be disconnected. You have to take the schools, the churches, the government, the bar, early pioneers, and you have to look at them in sections. Our way of presentation gives a holistic approach, just like a narrative of someone talking today about like what we're doing now, this interview. Only we're leapfrogging backwards and taking a period of time that is beyond any living person's range of memory.
Well, I saw you do one of these programs, and I know that audiences love it. I imagine children especially enjoy this.
Well, they get taken aback a little bit. Now, Melody Arnold, who works with me, plays my wife, and she's a feisty thing. And she gives Joseph, her name is Nancy Trowbaugh. And she is, she keeps him on the mark. And we try to make her a woman of that particular period, subject to the same kind of prejudices and so forth of that time. And by the two of them even bickering together, he has a tendency to make it much more realistic. Yes, then the children, then when we go into our impersonations, we tell them, we approach them first as the people of our period, who we really are, and then we go into our characters. But sometimes they lose sight of that, and even though we're trying to give an impression, they're somewhat shocked by us forcing them to think and feel like they are in another time period, and they have become time travelers. We do not refer to the 20th century at all. And while they have the knowledge of their lifestyles. We forced them then to look at a different lifestyle and maybe how they would react if put in this kind of a circumstance. So it becomes not only an appeal to the eye with the impressionist of the costuming, the period clothing, but it also affects them audibly by talking in a different way and doing well. They also have a chance to participate in some of our programs out here, which are geared toward rural life of the middle 19th century. So then they learn by doing. So by appealing to all of the sensory organs, then it is blocked in their mind then. And then they become able to realize that there has been a great change in lifestyle and environmentally. The area around us has changed from that time. This becomes a benchmark then. Because today we're living in a fast-moving society, and this society has lost all its benchmarks. The family is threatened, institutions are threatened, and people move around a lot. Those things that we used to take for granted aren't always the same. So we need these benchmarks. We need things to refer back to. Where have we been? How do we know where we're going if we don't know where we've been? So that's the reasoning behind some of this.
Let's talk a little more about the center. You told us how it came about, which was a marvelous story, and you have indicated exactly where it is. But what are some of the services now and the reasons that people come, and maybe something about the people who come here?
Oh, very good. Well, like many people say, we're one of the best kept secrets in Macon County. We've been in existence since 1967. But I would say, and I would wager, that probably 3/4 of the adult population in Decatur does not realize that we even exist, even though we're on the bottom of their tax bill. The district has grown slowly over those years because what they first had to do is to purchase the land that was individual farms, wooded areas, and wetlands and dry lands and what have you, and put them together in some kind of contiguous forms. And over those years, Rock Springs was put together, which is now 2,000 and about 23 acres, plus or minus. We have Friends Creek Regional Park up near Argentia. And we have the Griswold Conservation Area, which includes the one Blue Mound there at Blue Mound. We have Fort Daniel Regional Park, which is just east of Spittler Woods. And we have the Sand Creek Reservation, which lies near Mount Gilead and borders on the Elwyn, Mount Zion, Blacktop. Most of these have, other than Blue Mound, or excuse me, Griswold, have large forested areas in them. In the time that these were put together, Decatur was undergoing great growth, suburbs. Decatur was growing and Mount Zion was growing toward one another. Sand Creek, for example, now is the buffer between it. Rock Springs on the southwest corner of Decatur was very much threatened of being developed. But the district being here stopped development in those areas and set these wild areas aside. And as a result, by preserving habitat, the trees, grasses and allowing the land to grow back up in trees. Most of Rock Springs, or not most, but a good portion of it was landfill. They dumped old buildings here, or they mined first gravel out of this area. So now these scars are now healing. Nature has a tendency to heal itself. It provides habitat for animals. After we came into existence, all of a sudden the deer population started increasing in Macon County, as well as other wild animals.
Please refer.
In the years after the district started putting the land together and the trees grew up, it provided the habitat then for a lot of different animals that just weren't here before. And in fact, it's not been too many years ago that we started having a deer season here in Macon County that didn't exist for years and years. And so I think what we have done, part of the job that the Conservation Act provided for, by setting and keeping nature, providing for nature a place for it to occur. We just can't go out and plow everything up. Now, granted, a lot of people don't feel that way. They feel that we have taken land off the tax rolls. But most of the land that we have is very marginal. Lots of hills, not suitable for farming, simply because they were always forested and the soil is too thin. It might grow some crops, and did back in early pioneer times, and then it eroded. And it's just unsuitable. Oh yes, it would be nice for houses. But then again, we still have to have a place for the rest of the visitors here that are on our planet with us. And as a result, we have provided that. Less than 1% of the total land in Macon County belongs to the Conservation District, and we're letting it grow back. In fact, we're even helping it in some respects, where in some of the field systems that were here, we have replanted prairie grass. It'll never look like the prairies that were once here, long destroyed, but it's beginning to give the impression of what it was once like here in Macon County. And as a result, a lot of the critters that lived in the prairie are starting to come back to the prairie. People, of course, are an important asset to this place, because now they have an opportunity, everyone, to come out here, or to any one of our areas, not only just a picnic or to take a walk in the woods, but have a chance to see some of these things. In years before the district existed, then if a person wanted to walk out on the river, they had to go into other people's property. And some folks get uptight about things like that. A lot of people did not have an opportunity, especially urban dwellers and the children, to see what our environment actually is. Not the environment that they're living in, but the environment of the country in the area that they're living in. So by providing programming with the naturalist staff here, with the school children, especially in the primary grades, we have been fairly successful in getting, at least in those grades, many, many of the urban children out here. Now many come here very wary, because especially those children from the inner city, because this area is totally foreign to their city environment, the alleys, the streets, the traffic, the muggings, and what have you that occur. They come out here and they surely expect alligators, bears, tigers, everything. And many want to hold our hands. They are that frightened of the unknown. Not to mention that perhaps their parents are too. But there's nothing to be afraid of. And by their visits here, even as short as they are, an hour at a time, that we are able to interpret to them some aspect of their natural surroundings, and they have that chance to see what their natural surroundings are. One of the unfortunate things about living in the city is, and tied up in industry and business, crowded neighborhoods and so forth, is that we have a tendency as a people to think that this is the real world, because this is what we perceive, this is what we see around us. And the real world is that, where you work, where you go to school, where you sleep, where you live, grocery stores, streets, entertainment, that's the real world. But it isn't. The real world is where you live and how nature controls that world. We can't make the sun come up or we can't make it go down. We cannot really affect the rain as much as we'd like to think that we do. Sometimes when the electricity goes off, many people in the community panic. However, there's a lot of people living among us who never had electricity and still don't get excited when it goes off. But we have a lot of people who feel that the world is coming to an end when the electricity goes off. We have become so dependent upon the world that we have built around us that we've lost sight of the world that really exists out there, that if everything stops, can we survive? Well, to get them familiar with this world is one of the things that we have to do. But we also provide an area for people to, well, I guess you could call it unorganized recreation, that they can just come out and they can take a walk. They can walk through the woods, they can walk through a meadow, they can sit in a meadow, or they can sit under a tree and maybe not see another person. And it is something in our bodies that finds that very relaxing. And we find many people come here, businessmen, for example, doctors, lawyers, what have you, just to relax. It's better than taking 2 aspirin and call me in the morning. It's better than taking a lot of tranquilizers sometimes, is to get away and to get back into the real world. Cross-country skiing is being offered, especially this winter, 1983-84, that we've got some snow, and that provides opportunity for people now to get out and see nature in a season when they normally wouldn't go out because it's too hard to walk in the snow, excuse me. And the skis provide that access to see what's going on in a different season. There are those, even though, that do walk in the winter and enjoy nature. Deer are much easier to see in the winter than they are in the summer when they're hiding. So that the district and its properties then provide that ability for the people to go out free of charge and see nature as it exists in Central Illinois. As the years go by, then the trees will get better, bigger, and more varied. This will eventually turn into an oak hickory forest here. and be much more prettier than it is today as it's growing in toward that point. So the real beauty of the woods of the Midwest will become apparent in about 50 to 75 years, and probably we'll never see it. But our children and our children's children will. And all of those critters and their progeny will all exist for them to enjoy. If we didn't save it now, or then, and take care of it now, then it won't be. So that's our legacy for the future.
You may have covered this somewhat, but do you see a change in the way that people have viewed nature over the years? From the time you were growing up to now?
Oh, yes. This is always good for good discussions, because when I was growing up in the 50s, in the 60s, that this was a time, as you said, of optimism. And this was a time when everybody was doing different things. And we were free to do different things. We had unlimited resources to do those things. And we did them. And in this country, we built a standard of living that's unmatched. And we were a consuming nation. And it was a throwaway society. These are terms that are very popular. And there were warnings that were thrown at us that we didn't pay any attention to, like the resources that we're using are finite, that there is a limit to what you can do. Well, as long as it was cheap and abundant, we don't care. Gas was running out as far as natural gas. Gasoline oil was becoming hard to come by, but not in this country. And then the Arabs turned the oil off, and we came to our senses. And now the trend is, maybe also add at the other time, that a revolution was going on in agriculture. We were finding that you can put all kinds of chemicals on the farms and increase your yields. We also found that we could stop the weeds, and we could also stop the bugs that were chewing up our crops. But we were also paying for it, in that a lot of the material put on, especially nitrates, on the fields were washing down into Lake Decatur. And we were drinking them and creating a problem for ourselves in our bodies. Every day we find that there's more and more things that are in our food that are causing problems in our bodies. Well, cancer rates up, heart disease rates are high. I think we're coming to our senses now. The environmental movement of the late 60s and the early 70s, which we preceded the environmental movement, I'm proud to say here and make again. And that during this time, it became apparent on a national scale that we were doing a lot of bad things to ourselves. A lot of studies were started in the schools, which are now resulting in good hard data that proves that a lot of it was correct, and we are trying to change our ways. So I feel that now, in the universities and in the grade and the schools, that, and especially what we're trying to teach here, is a more tolerant attitude toward nature, that to survive as a people, we must come to realize that we share this planet with the trees and the grasses and the animals. And even though we built a technological society that seems omnipotent, that seems at our control, that we can even control to the point the air around us. We felt now that we are isolated from nature. And that's no more. We're not isolated from nature. And we have to be aware that it is an integral part of our very survival. And that we have to learn to live with it. We cannot be above nature. We have to live with it. So people then are slowly coming around to that realization. Oh yes, there will be diehards. Those who will not recognize that fact. But we're just going to have to survive.
Well, that really is a thrilling story. It shows that your efforts are paying off and that you're bringing pleasure to many thousands of people who wouldn't have had the opportunity otherwise. We certainly appreciate all that you have done and all that you have told us here this morning, Mr. Slider. We thank you very much for all these experiences and reminiscences. And we want you to know that we really appreciate what is being done here.
Well, I hope that future generations appreciate it too.
I'm sure they will. And thank you very much. You have been listening to the experiences of Mr. R. Lee Slider, and this is Betty Trunell speaking for the Decatur Public Library.